so many moving parts. Good evening, everybody. My name is Hiro Sasaki. I am an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here, grateful to be sober. Thank you, Mark, for... I lost where you are. Where are you? Oh, there you are. You're right there, right behind me. Or in front of me now, but behind me earlier. Thank you for inviting me to come up here, and I want to thank Daniel for that 10 minutes and for driving up with me. A little while ago, a former grand sponsee asked me on a Friday night during our Friday night meeting is a participation meeting, and people share for like up to 5 minutes on what we were like, what happened, and what we're like today. And he asked me, why do you make everyone feel uncomfortable before you say who you are? And I let him know that that's just me trying to access some power so that you don't just get me. And I was just praying for God to demonstrate through me what God can do. I have a sobriety date. It's November 12, 2007. It's the only sobriety date I've ever had. Knock wood. Sorry, that echoed a little bit. And I think that's the case for a couple reasons. One, I tried everything not to come here, including a suicide attempt. And I was done. I was surrendered, and I kept having to surrender over and over and over again. And which is hard for, I'm Japanese American, so that's kind of tough to like surrender again. And both Daniel and I belong to the Big Book group. We're in Bellflower. Our main meeting is on a Monday night. If you're ever in Southern California on a Monday night, please come join us. I've got cards. He'll give out his number. I'll give out my number. And if you give me like a couple weeks lead time, I'll change my schedule for that week, and we'll meet up. And we have about 300 people on a Monday night, and we'll get there when there's like 20 people, like the people who set up the chairs and the old timers that are there. We'll say hi to them. We'll go grab some dinner. We'll come back for the beginners meeting. There's this little half hour meeting before the actual meeting where someone shares on what it was like in the first 90 days with an ask it basket, and then they ask questions. And because my group is like a pathologically rule following group, kind of like this one, after we pray out, we're like in three lines at the three aisles, and what we're doing is we're thanking the speaker. And then you see us all scatter off like little worker bees or ants. Some of us are scattering off to take care of our nicotine addiction. The rest of us are doing our pre-meeting commitments. And I'm currently a bathroom captain, or Captain Bathroom, as I like to call me. And I love that commitment. And then I love getting in the greeting line. The greeting line at our home group grows to be like about two blocks long. Like, it's intense. And if you're someone like me, where like stone cold sober, like even before you had your first drink, you've got a really busy mind that's really mean to you. Like, it's like my mind is all, Hiro, you suck more than anyone's ever sucked before. And occasionally, like, I'll awaken out of my like narcissistic self-hatred. I'll be like, oh, except for that guy. Look at that guy. That guy sucks more. And because I was made in Japan and raised here, I've got the shame and the entitlement. It always comes in the wrong order. So if I see somebody who's behaving like inappropriately, I'm very happy to tell them what an idiot they are. And then if they become scary, which many people do, no matter what size, age, gender, I run because I'm a coward. And then I get home, and then my head is telling me how much I suck because that was just stupid. And I'm just, ah, you suck. And so if you got a head like mine, you should come join me in the greeting line. Because what will happen is about 7:10 for our 7:30 meeting, people are coming in really fast. Like that one movie that changed my life as a kid. People now think of it as episode 4 of Star Wars, but for us it was just Star Wars. And there's this moment where they're trying to like, it's a last ditch effort to like battle the evil empire, and they're trying to get to the Death Star, and they're outnumbered, and like, they're coming in too fast. That's how it feels, right, when you're in the greeting line. And one person after another, and if you just think of your one primary purpose, which is to invite them in and try to memorize three names, that's it, then what will happen is just for a brief period of time, it's just welcoming people to AA, welcoming people to AA, welcoming people to AA, and you'll discover that for 10 seconds, 20 seconds, a minute, 5 full minutes, maybe even 15 minutes until you have to pee and wash the alcoholics off your hands, that you won't be thinking about yourself, which is amazing for alcoholics like us, right? I have a sponsor. His name is Johnny H. He founded my home group in 1972. I just did a sponsorship change. Like, I had this experience where ever since COVID, every spring I would write this inventory about, do I need to change sponsors? Every time, it's come up no. The inventory came up no. But I know in Alcoholics Anonymous what it feels to be called to do something. And the first thing that I was called to do was, I was called to figure out if there was anything else I can do in order to not have to die. And I discovered that it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I felt called to do this time was I felt called to be sponsored in my home group. I've never been sponsored in my home group. I've always had a sponsor, like for the last 12 years, I've had a sponsor out of state. And before that, I had a sponsor from my previous home group. And it's a deal changer. I thought I was just, I didn't think I was cheating anybody, but it turned out I was cheating my sponsees, their sponsees, their sponsees, their sponsees, and I think one more, and their sponsee, that of having a legacy in their own home group. I was cheating them of that. Being able to sit in a group where they've got an entire sponsorship line all the way to the founder of the group. And that's profound. Like, all of a sudden I'm finding out at, what is it, today is... Ten days, 9 months, and 16 years without a drink or a drug or anything that affects me from the neck up. And all of a sudden, in my own home group, once again, I'm sitting all the way down, feeling safe and protected in my home group, which is an amazing thing. Daniel didn't want me to, but I want to. He got sober on January 14th of 92. And so, you could... This is the crazy thing. I couldn't get any of my sponsees to come with me, because it's a long drive. And so I call up Daniel 2 days ago, and I'm like, "Hey, you want to go on an AA adventure?" And he's like, "What does that mean?" "Well, that means I'm going to pick you. I'm going to come to your place like about 2:30. I'm going to come and look at all the art that you've painted." He's an amazing artist. His art is gorgeous. And I'm going to look at that stuff, and then we're going to leave about 3:00, and then we're going to drive up. We're going to drive up to Lancaster, and then we're going to like eat some food up there, and we'll probably get lost once or twice because user error. But we're going to leave early enough that we're going to get there, and then we'll still arrive at the meeting early. I'm going to try and get to the meeting an hour early, but we'll probably get there about 20 minutes early, which is exactly what happened. And then we'll get back like around 11:30. It'll be a full 8-hour experience. It's like a work shift. And he says yes right away. Yes. And what that means is that we got to have a meeting. We got to have a meeting coming up here, and we got to have a meeting going back. And what are we talking about? We're not talking about the latest movie. We're not talking about the hot people that have joined our group. We're talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and God. That's it. And it's a beautiful thing. For those of you that are new, welcome. You probably noticed that AA is freaking weird, dude. It's... I mean, I'm a science fiction fantasy horror guy, so I think of AA kind of like as a group of vampires, right? Except we're not trying to like drain you of blood, but we need you. You're the lifeblood of for us because, basically it's like this: we get high on you, newcomer. It's not a threat. We're not gonna like dry you out and like roll you up and smoke you, or like put you in the rails and snort you, or like melt you down in a spoon and shoot you. Rather, what we're gonna do is we're gonna do exactly what was done with us, which is like if you ask any one of us to sponsor you, what we're gonna do is we're gonna first give you some simple suggestions, like how to show up at a meeting, how to get there early, how to stay late, how to start calling other people. And it's like, why? Well, because you're thinking too much about yourself. I'm like, okay, and then start going through the big. I have a little version of the big book. Start going through the big book one line at a time. And one of the things that we love in Alcoholics Anonymous is start seeing the light turn on in newcomers' eyes. And I know today what my job is. My job today is to talk to the people who are in their first 30 days and to talk to the people in their last 30 days and to talk to anyone else who may be suffering in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's my job. When I first heard someone talk about the last 30 days, I got those like AA God shivers on my neck and my arm, like my hair stood up, like I'm thinking, wait, is that me? And how do I know it's me? It's, well, how judgmental am I? How much am I starting to think like Larry T in my home group? Larry talks about, my sobriety brother Larry talks about how he hates it, and so do I. He put words to this thing I hate. He hates it when people in Alcoholics Anonymous start to think that normal living is the cure for alcoholism. And the thing is that the things that pull me away, that call me away from all the worldly clamors, all the cool, shiny, noisy things that happen in the world. Oh, I can go this way. Oh, I can go that way. All the things I get to have in my life today that can draw me away from Alcoholics Anonymous, the source of all the good that's happened in my life today. And it pulls me away from a life-giving source, and it pulls me away from the place that I get to be of service. And unless I'm of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, my life starts getting claustrophobic and small and dark and tunnel vision. It's like when you're about to black out, like sometimes it just goes pew, right? And it seems like my life is like that. And I'm really, really grateful that I know where the solution is today. I'm going to go backwards. I'm supposed to let you know what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I'm going to start a little bit with what I'm like today. Like we're having a fellowship, and you heard Amir say that we're a fellowship of people who've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. When I first heard the word fellowship, I only heard it in kind of religious context in the past. That's not true. I heard it in religious context and Hobbit context. I couldn't really understand how either one would help me. Right? I thought, well, yeah, cosplay would be fun, but I don't know. And clearly, I'm in cosplay now. This is my AA drag. And what I've learned today is what a fellowship is. A fellowship is a group of people who have the same problem, who've also found the same solution. And we've taken a vow. We've taken a vow to care for one another, to nurture one another, to love one another, to take responsibility for one another. And the unit of survival in Alcoholics Anonymous is always a minimum of two. Yeah, absolutely, me and God, me and God, me and God. But I get confused about who's God and who's me if I'm not talking to you. And I just got back from Ocean Shores, Washington, and what happened was me and a sponsee, Joe. I started sponsoring Joe when I was 6 months sober. He got a really good life. He got a union job. It pulled him away from AA. And right now he's just got a little over 2 years, and he's so surrendered. And so he gets on a plane with me, and we fly from LAX. We fly into Seattle, and my sponsee Charlie drives down from Port Townsend and picks us up at the Seattle Tacoma Airport. And he drives us over to this little skilled nursing facility. And so we can visit this woman that has helped all three of us. This woman that I met when I was about 30 days sober. This woman who was one of the founders with Johnny of my home group, like set up chairs with him in September 1972. This woman named Judy Caduti. Judy had had a stroke in December, like right before her 53rd AA anniversary. And she's someone who was just so full of AA, and she still was full of AA, and she only had two words left. She's had this massive stroke, and she had two words left. And her two words were yeah and wow. And it's amazing how you can have a deep and tearful conversation with someone with only two words. Like she's asleep, and Charlie goes and checks with the charge nurse that we should wake her up. And the charge nurse is like, absolutely, wake her up. So I rub her hand, and her Japanese name is Emiko. And so I'm like, Emiko, here she does. And she opens her eyes up, and she recognizes me. And she immediately just goes, wow. And I start sitting by her side, and I start telling her a little bit of what's going on. I start telling her, you know what, this past March, I asked Johnny to sponsor me. I was talking to Ann, another one of the old timers in my home group, Ann W. And I was saying, you know, I wrote this inventory, and it was clear once again, 4 years in a row, I don't need to leave Bob. But now I felt called to get sponsored by Johnny. Johnny's 93 with 63 years sober. And if I'm gonna have a hand, if I want to be serious about continuing the legacy of my home group, when at whatever time he goes up to join the big meeting in the sky and starts getting coffee for everyone else who got there first, that I need to be sponsored in my home group. And I'm telling her this story, and she's saying, wow. And I'm telling her all this stuff, and it's all full of wows and yes. And there's a book that you don't need to read. It's a book by one of my favorite writers, Anne Lamott. The book is called Help, Thanks, Wow. And Anne Lamott says that these are three of the basic prayers that we need to survive in life. Help, thanks, wow. The fourth one I like is Use Me. I like that one, especially because of the Bill Withers song and because of Commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we have ourselves an experience up there. And so to go back, I was made in Japan, brought here when I was about a year old to Canada, following my mom and my mom and I followed my dad, who was doing a PhD studying organic chemistry at McMaster University in Canada. My earliest memories are from there, snow people, and then we moved from there to Tucson, Arizona, for my dad's first postdoc, and this is where consciousness first starts coming online, and I start realizing how different I am from others, and I know I can't change my eyes, I can't change my face, I can't change my hair, but I can change how I speak. And I wanted really to fit in linguistically. And so I learned how to, I really quickly learned how to differentiate between THs and Ss, something my parents were never able to do, Rs and Ls. But I also did this thing where I was able to get articles right that my parents were never able to get right, like the and a, you know, indefinite. But and also pronouns, like I was saying shiz for hers, and so I started to get pronouns correct and started to sound like a native. I wanted to just fit in linguistically. And then I master it. I can sound like a native. And then what happens after 2 years there for nursery school and kindergarten, my dad gets another postdoc. And my dad had a huge brain. He studied organic chemistry. His first postdoc was in organic chemistry. He's getting desperate because he can't find another postdoc for organic chemistry. So he decides he's going to switch, and he gets a two-year postdoc in inorganic chemistry. So he goes from like the chemistry of oxygen to the chemistry of polymers. And I guess the medical version would be like being an ear, nose, throat doctor and suddenly becoming an opgyn, right? And like suddenly becoming like a gynecologist. And sure, they're all holes, but they're very different. So next thing I know, for first grade, we're moving to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. It's 1971. And so next thing I know, like, we're the Asian family in Tuscaloosa. And all of a sudden, linguistically, I'm an alien again. Because, you know, I don't know if you know, like, in Tuscaloosese, the word hi has three syllables. You know, it's like, hi! And so I don't fit in, like, visually or linguistically. And I'm a chameleon, though, so I learn how to sound Southern real fast. And I didn't know that at the age of 42, I'd be required to surrender to a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm sure that there are AA historians and AA scholars in the room and that would be delighted to tell me that the word surrender is not in the first 164 pages. And you're right. The word concede is, that the first step is that I concede to my innermost self that I am an alcoholic. And a concession is a full letting in. And in order to fully let in, I need to tear down my walls. I need to put down all the weapons and I didn't know that surrender is this like nobody likes surrendering, man. Nobody. One of the things Alcoholics Anonymous gave me, it gave me like a tenure track job at the age of 45. Like I got a tenure track job at a small Buddhist university in Rosemead, right? Little tiny like 2,000 person school, 1/10 of the student body, Buddhist monks and nuns, right? And my office next door neighbor was the chair of the Buddhist chaplaincy master's program, and she had this painting that was gorgeous. It has like the Buddha with like a Wonder Woman kind of lasso, and the Buddha's got a lasso around this like monk, and it's around the monk's waist, and there's a bodhisattva and a bodhisattva. Bodhisattvas are kind of like what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and in the Buddhist tradition, bodhisattvas are beings who have attained enlightenment, and they've been released from the cycle of birth, birth, suffering, sickness, old age, death, and rebirth. They've been freed from that. But they, instead of being released from the cycle of reincarnation, they decide to stay on Earth. Why do they decide to stay on Earth? They decide to stay on Earth to stay here and make sure that all living beings become free. Like, that's kind of like what we do in AA. That's kind of like the 12th step in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, so there's the Bodhisattva of compassion, like pulling on this lasso along with the Buddha, and there's another Bodhisattva behind this monk trying to push him, and he's shoving, and the monk has his heels dug in, and he's on a meditation cushion. He's got his heels dug in, and he's leaning back, and his eyes are closed, and he can't see that the place he's being pulled to is this place of freedom, and this place of just being completely free from all of our guilt, all of our worries, all the workings of our just self-condemnatory minds, the prison of our own existence and the prison of our minds, and freedom is just right there. He's got his eyes closed right there. That's me. And that's what surrender's like. But of course, I don't know this in first grade. In first grade, surrender feels like this. Like I'm walking up to the cool kids who are pushed up at the corner after first grade, and they're all, "Oh, here comes Hiro, let's play war, you play the Japs." And I'm like, "Oh, great, again? Okay," you know, because I want to fit in. And, you know, I didn't have language for it then. It didn't feel good. At best, it was like hazing, maybe some bullying, maybe some casual racism, maybe some microaggression. I didn't have these words. All I knew is it didn't feel good, but it kind of felt good, but it felt really awful at the same time. It was very weird and masochistic. And after 2 years there, we moved to Southern California. We moved to Claremont, California, gorgeous town, 6 colleges, a theological seminary, large Asian American population, a lot of Japanese Americans living just a couple towns over in Azusa. And it turns out that if you're an Asian American like me that hasn't been raised around other Asian Americans, those Asian Americans have a word for me. They're calling me things like Twinkie and banana, yellow on the outside, white on the inside. Like, I don't fit in even around Asian Americans, right? Ugh. So needless to say, when I had my first drink at the age of 12, I was ready. And it was like, I'm thirsty now. So And basically, my buddy Dave just shows me how to drink some tall boys and smoke these funny green cigarettes real slow and drink real fast. And somehow I instinctively knew just to go. And doing this a few times and puffing on that little thing, I found that, you know, like, I'm the kind of guy where my idea of a good time is memorizing pi for another 10 digits or figuring out what the largest, like, prime number is, or, you know, rolling some, like, 20-sided dice to figure out, like, what's going to happen in the next room in the dungeon. And and now all of a sudden I can't stop laughing and I'm having a hard time walking. I'm going, oh, my God. This is the best thing. Well, I hadn't quite hit puberty, so I was like, oh, my God. And I was so excited to go to algebra. In my home group today, the guy who sat behind me in algebra just took 1 year. That's Greg S. Yeah. Yeah, so good. Anyway, so now here's the thing about me. I really like pleasure, and I really don't like pain. And people call that hedonism. And so I chase pleasure pathologically. And I avoid pain pathologically. And it turns out what's really, and I'm a peak experience guy. Like, I want to have peak. I was telling Daniel that you know, I got to see, in the same day, I got to see Santana do a 3-hour set and the Grateful Dead do a 3-hour set and doing just like Owsley Acid and this woo on like the third day of the first US Festival. And so I love peak experiences, right? And the problem with me is that the more I chase peak experiences, the further in the past they become. And the more I chase pleasure, the more fleeting, and the more I can't get to it. The more I avoid pain, the more it feels like pain is completely unavoidable. Like, I am pain body. And I end up at age 16 with a handful of Valium and a handful of Librium, just ready to die with a bottle of Bacardi 151. It was calculated across my blood-brain barrier and just take me off into that dark at night. But I forgot I was a puker, so there was a cleanup in my room. And to speed through the rest of my story, I'm really, really good at depression on my own, even without alcohol and drugs, but alcohol and drugs kind of speed up that process, because it's like Homer Simpson at Moe's Tavern going, "Mo, I'm so depressed. Please pour me another central nervous system depressant." And I'm really also good at anxiety. So depression, like psychologists say that the thinking style, cognitive psychologists talk about the thinking style of depression. It's a pervasive negative view of self, world, and future. I mean, you know that, right? Like, I suck and you suck and we're all gonna suck forever, right? That space, I'm good at that. I'm also really good at anxiety. I don't know, maybe you've had this happen where your brain wakes you up at 3 a.m. going, "Hey, wake up, mother effer, time to worry." And you're just like, "Oh." This actually happened at the Step Ashore conference. I was a Saturday night speaker, and I'm having like borderline sleep deprivation psychosis because I'm just not sleeping well. Bad, new environment, overstimulated, because I'm an ambivert, and which means yes, this feeds me, but it takes a long time to downregulate afterwards, and I feel like that movie, A Beautiful Mind, like, this is what I'm going to say, no, this is what I'm going to say, this one, and all these kind of little chains of, like, talks of that responding to other people's talks, and I feel completely crazy, and I can't get it to stop, and then I remember, oh, I forgot I can pray. And I get down on the floor, and I do some restorative yoga, I put my feet on the wall, I do the serenity prayer, the Thursday prayer, the seven-step prayer, the 11-step prayer, I do a cycle of breathing, and I get back in bed asleep. And the horrible thing about when your brain wakes you up, telling you to worry, it's this horrible lie that I believe. Like that night, just a couple weeks ago, I believed it for 90 minutes. The lie is this: if you and I can worry about the future as hard as we can, buddy, we're going to be able to change it. Right? And this is obviously absurd. But I can't see the truth from the false in a state like this. And so here's what happens. I'm really confusing to me and people who love me because I'm really successful until I'm not. And so I graduate from high school. Someone helped me to take a class I didn't take until the Saturday before graduation. So I'm like, okay, good. I didn't realize first aid was that important. And so I get that class in. I get into my safety school, which is one of the big schools in LA. I get in there. It takes me 7 years to graduate from there instead of 4. I get into a top 25 PhD program in English literature in the Midwest. I end up having what I think is seasonal affective disorder and graduate student writer's block. And so I take the credits I finished. I get into the other big university in Los Angeles with a full ride, and I get there, and I don't even know the word taking a geographic, which is like trying to escape my problems in one place. It's a locational problem, then realizing I'm the problem because now I've got seasonal affective disorder in Los Angeles where there's a lot of sun, and I still have the graduate student writer's block with half my papers, and here I am. And the reason I have a full ride is because I'm teaching freshman writing at this university while being unable to finish my own papers, right? And I'm doing all the reading, going to all my classes, being able to have the talk, but I have this arrogance and this entitlement that tells me I shouldn't have to write the paper because I already thought it through, I already did all the writing, I already talked about it, not really realizing, no, that's actually the grind, that's the hard work that proves that I'm eligible for like a degree. And so I end up dropping out of that place. I meet my wife, and she was so good. She's like, when I first asked her out, she's like, "Well, just as friends, right? Because I'm not going to date anyone until I get my PhD." I'm like, "Oh yeah, of course." And we end up getting together on April 29th of 92, which was the big civil unrest in Los Angeles that was then called the LA riots. And we get married in 95, and I don't get sober until 2007. So you can do the misery math. And two pictures. So I end up solving my graduate student writer's block. It's one of the things I do today. I help people with writer's block. I help people with perfectionism. I've helped people with high stakes testing, like for the jurisprudence exam, the medical licensing exam, etc. I help people with high performance environments. I just took on a patient today who is a resident at Memorial, and who's high achieving and unlike us, just by having a space to kind of talk about her problem, she's going to get better. We if you're an alcoholic, that's not enough. That's just not enough. And what happens is I get over all that stuff, and I'm really confusing to myself because in the clutch, if I have something that's really important to me, I can stop for a while. until I can't. And so like I did a couple half marathons and as a kid, as a teenager, and was able to do those and not drink during the getting ready for them. And I would not drink for a while, but at some point I would start drinking and I don't realize I have alcoholism. And next thing I know, I'm drinking in a way that I don't approve of. And next thing I know, I'm dropping out. And it's really confusing. But this time I hold my stuff together all the way through another doctorate, this time in psychology. So about 6-7 months before my sobriety date, I'm having a psychotic episode in a hospital in which I work. And I'm doing the F-word mantra. I don't know if you know the F-word mantra. It's like F, 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 F. It's like Tourette's, but it's rhythmic. And I'm doing this behavior because I'm trying not to be actively psychotic. And if you've ever tried not to be actively psychotic, in other words, trying not to see the things that other people don't see and hear the things that other people don't hear, and being actively delusional, I mean, you read about the delusion that someday we're going to be like other people, we're going to be able to like drink like other people, that's the illusion. And the delusion I had was they're after me, they know. And if you've ever tried to not be psychotic, you know that it doesn't work. And the reason I was trying not to be psychotic was because I was required to leave that bathroom and go provide psychotherapy to a 7-year-old. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Because it's notoriously difficult to provide play therapy to a child with generalized anxiety disorder if the therapist, me, is more terrified than the child. The reason I'm terrified is the shadows keep moving. And so I don't go and try to help that kid because I know I'll be harmful. I have that much kind of ethical awareness and presence of mind and what I now understand is grace. And I go to my bosses and I tell them a little bit what's going on. They say, Hero, go take some time off. Please don't see your patients. We'll take care of them. Go get help through the employee assistance program. Find a professional. Go get some help. Get better. Come back when you're better. Please bring a note. So I do that thing. I do that thing that I've always been so good at on my own. Well, this time with a little bit of medical help. Until I finally wasn't able to do it well on my own. And what happens is I come back and maybe I'll be able to finish this pre-doctoral internship. Maybe I'll be able to not flame out at the tail end or the beginning of something really important to me like I always seem to do. All I have to do is not drink or use. That's it. So jump. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know that someone's going to invite me to a wine tasting. I'm going to have a strange mental blank spot. My life is going to start getting far more exciting until it becomes far more terrifying. And that about 30 days after that first drink at the wine tasting, where all I do is have some wine, that's it. That my wife's going to be confronting me with those dead glass taxidermy eyes, right? And she seems like nictating membranes in the eyes, like blink blink terror, blink blink contempt, blink blink horror, right? And like, who are you? What have you done with my husband? I don't know when I'm taking that drink that when I'm forgetting that I can't drink and taking that drink, that's the night that I'm going to make an SOS phone call. And I don't know that on that night that I'm making an SOS phone call when my wife confronts me, that I'm going to ignore all of the sober alcoholics that I had in my phone, and instead I'm going to call the one person who happened to be anonymous to me. I'm going to say to her, I'm going to have this surrender experience at 9:30 p.m. She's going to pick up on the third ring, and I'm going to tell her, you know, I don't trust my shrink. I don't like my shrink. I think I need a new shrink. I think I'm bipolar. I think I need some lithium. And she's gonna be bewildered that because she's never seen me or heard me in this kind of manic, terrified state, and she's going to ask me what's going on. And I don't know that I'm going to have this my first surrender where I tell her everything, where I just tell her everything. And then after the end of like burning through this confession of like all the skeezy acting out and all the crap I'm pouring into my body just to try and get to okay. And I can't even get to okay. Like that old movie Reservoir Dogs, that movie about the jewelry heist that goes wrong, and then like Harvey Keitel, he's the getaway driver, and there's a guy in the backseat who's gut shot, you know, gut wounds are bad, and he's in the back going, I'm gonna die, and the Harvey Keitel character is going, you're not gonna die, say it after me, you're not gonna die, and the guy in the back's going, I'm gonna die, you're gonna be okay, I can't even get to the space of like, I'm gonna be okay, I can't get there. And what happens after my confession is that she says, Hero, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober for 22 years. Maybe you need a meeting. And it feels like there's a branch 2 inches below my belly button that just goes pop, and I just start sobbing, like doing the stomach crunch, like ugly cry, involuntary, like sit-up kind of things. I'm just weeping. Because she's the one who taught me how to send you to AA. She's the one who taught me to tell you things like, you might not drink right. You might need this place called Alcoholics Anonymous. They know how to stay sober there. I can't help you with that. She taught me to tell you if you go to AA, go there to listen for similarities, not differences. Go there to listen. Go there to identify, not compare. She told me to tell you you might hear about God a lot, and if you don't believe in God, have trouble with God, don't worry about that. That's advanced AA. That's a later step. And I didn't know that the day after that I would go into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with a couple Xanax on board, because how do you go to a lot of people that you don't know without something? And that I would find someone who I identify with from the podium, who socioeconomically nothing like me. He's a taxi cab driver, but he's done things and felt things. He talks about having a gun in his mouth, stone cold sober. But today, as a result of having a home group, a sponsor, having gone through the steps with a sponsor, and always looking for more sponsees to take through the steps the way he was taken through them, that he's happy, joyous, and free most days. And I don't know that that's going to happen on that day that I'm invited to a wine tasting. And I don't know that as I go through this, I'm going to start making amends, and the first amends are going to be to my parents and to my wife. And I don't know that I'll meet this one man, Tim H., who now is a sobriety brother, but I met him like when I was about 30 days sober. No, about 2 weeks sober, at the Sunday night 12 and 12 meeting, sponsored by Johnny also. And I heard him, one of the first things I heard him say is that Johnny told me that the direct amends is just the announcement of the behavior change that started when I raised my hand and said, I'm an alcoholic, and then said to somebody, will you please sponsor me, and started doing what that person said. The behavior change that started then that I hope continues for the rest of my life until I take my last sober breath. And because of that, I was able to make that direct amends, and I was able then also to know that that was just an announcement of how I'm changing my behavior so I can behave like the son that they were trying to raise all along, my good, non-alcoholic immigrant parents. And as a result of that, they got to have a son for a decade for my dad, and for 11 years for my mom. The son that they were trying to raise, that they could rely on, the eldest son. And I started to experience what legacy feels like. I thought legacy was a burden. No, what it is hope. And I was able, and Alcoholics Anonymous was able to make that hope manifest. And I didn't know that in 2019, my father, after taking me and my wife to Japan, and his goal when we went there together was to show me how to ride the trains at the busiest station in the world, and at the busiest time in the world, and not get lost, so that I can take others there, so that at 3 a.m. if I'm hungry, how to take people to the store and get amazing food at the Japanese version of 7-Eleven, which might actually start here, which is very exciting, but there's no affiliation, so never mind, I didn't say that from the podium. So I don't know that in October of September of 2019, he's going to have a fall in Japan after beating cancer 3 times, and then by December, and he's going to be there in with my brother and my brother's then new wife, and by December he's going to fall and not be able to get up, and by January he won't be able to sit up in bed on his own. He won't be able to like even use a spoon, or he can hardly hold a bowl and get it to his face. And we don't know until after he passes that what was happening is that all the myelin around all of his neurons, that's the fatty tissue around his neurons, was disappearing really fast, like what happens in Parkinson's or what happens with multiple sclerosis. But his was like Parkinson's on meth. It's kind of like the opposite of what happens with child development, right? But he was doing child development backwards, super fast, like in the course of months. And I don't know that in the evenings he's going to start forgetting English, and he's only going to be speaking Japanese, and he's not going to know that he doesn't know English. And that because Judy has been taken, because I was on Judy duty, she doesn't drive, still doesn't drive, obviously, but when I was like about 30 days sober, she started telling me, Hiroshi, pick me up at 5:30 on Tuesday, don't be late, and she would have me drive her to the Japanese-speaking meeting. And as a result of going to the Japanese-speaking meeting weekly, I was able to go show up for my dad and do exactly what you told me to do, what she told me to do, was to talk. He might seem asleep, he might seem unconscious, he might seem delirious, just tell him all the stuff you're grateful for. And I would go there and I would talk to him in Japanese and talk to him about stuff like, hey, remember that time that we summited Whitney, not up the pukey West Slope, but all the way down John Muir Trail, like 50 miles down, those 75-pound packs, and how cold it was at night, and how amazing those really crappy meals, those freeze-dried meals tasted. And we got up all the way to the top of Whitney, how we could see all the way to the Pacific, and we could almost imagine that we see like the waves of grain out that way, just below the clouds, and how good that felt. Now that the state of not knowing that you have a condition, like for any dementing disorder, for example, is called anosognosia. Gnosia, knowledge or wisdom, like agnostic, without knowledge or wisdom, whether God is or isn't. But in this case, it's knowledge or wisdom, A, without, nozo, disease, without knowledge or wisdom that he's in a disease process. He does not know that he doesn't know English. On that day, about 30 days before my sobriety date, someone invites me to a wine tasting. I had anosognosia. I had no idea. I knew earlier that morning that I couldn't take a drink. I knew. And someone asked me, it's so exciting, and it's so civilized. You have the little tasters, and you go from light to dark, and it's delightful. And then, of course, it ended up not delightful. I've got 2 minutes left. We just got done with the Olympics. And I think Alcoholics Anonymous is like all the sports events in the Olympics. And a lot of you are like, love sports teams. And we're kind of like a sports team. And what we do is we're filled with like huge egos, right? And what do? We come here and we drill. We do the same thing. Every day we do the same thing. We pray. We talk to each other. We give each other hope. And we drill and we drill and we drill. And it's this thing where by doing the same thing over and over and over, just like a team that might have been a losing team just 5 years ago, now is able to do stellar things, things that shouldn't be humanly possible, that takes years and years of intense, like a lifetime of intensive trainings for elite athletes, happens for alcoholics. In Alcoholics Anonymous, just after a simple surrender and a question, will you sponsor me? And then picking up the phone and making the call. That the impossible is possible every single day in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to just dismiss it. And I just want to go, oh, let me go get mine at my job. Oh, let me go get mine in my retirement. Let me go. But no, this is where the juice is. This is where the power is. I was just talking with a buddy of mine in Ohio, another sober alcoholic, Paul G. And he and his wife, Christina, were crossing over into Canada. And they're about to go into a station the Nikola Tesla station. Nikola Tesla worked in Edison's lab, and Nikola Tesla was all about direct current. And he had this utopian vision that someday electricity would like go through the air and it would go through the ground, and we can just plug into the ground and get all the power we want. And this would eliminate us from oil. This would eliminate us from coal. This would eliminate us from nuclear. This would free so many things. And of course, that hasn't happened yet in electricity, but it's happened spiritually in Alcoholics Anonymous. Please stay. Please get plugged in. Please join us. Thank you.